From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Over the past 2 years, what began as a series of peaceful protests against the repressive regime of Bashar al-Assad has turned into a brutal civil war. Over 100,000 people have been killed. Millions have fled the country.
That was U.S. President Barack Obama in an address to the nation on September 10th of 2013.
In that time, America's worked with allies to provide humanitarian support, to help the moderate opposition, and to shape a political settlement. But I have resisted calls for military action because we cannot resolve someone else's civil war through force, particularly after a decade of war in Iraq and Afghanistan. The situation profoundly changed, though, on August 21st, when Assad's government gassed to death over 1,000 people, including hundreds of children. The images from this massacre are sickening.
For many in the West, those images came via the BBC, which showed video of both children and adults, apparently in severe pain and severely damaged from chemical burns.
Men, women, children lying in rows, killed by poison gas. Others foaming at the mouth, gasping for breath. A father clutching his dead children, imploring them to get up and walk.
As in the run-up to the 1991 Iraq War, the 2003 Iraq War, and the war on Libya, the images provoked a massive outrage among the Western political class and media.
On that terrible night, the world saw in gruesome detail the terrible nature of chemical weapons and why the overwhelming majority of humanity has declared them off-limits, a crime against humanity, and a violation of the laws of war.
For President Obama, that meant something had to be done.
And that is why, after careful deliberation, I determined that it is in the national security interests of the United States to respond to the Assad regime's use of chemical weapons through a targeted military strike.
However, that threat of military action provoked a massive outrage in the United States and around the world. The president clearly anticipated this and told the American people he would take no action until he referred the matter to Congress. However, Britain's parliament had already voted on the matter a week and a half before the president spoke and voted down any action by its military. The wind was also taken out of the president's sails with respect to military action against Syria when Russia brokered a deal for Syria to completely surrender its entire stockpile of chemical weapons and join the international treaty prohibiting their use or possession. It was at this time that the U.S. was closest to direct involvement in the Syrian war. Such involvement was pursued by the Obama administration up to the end of the president's term. However, the current president, Donald Trump, campaigned on a promise to end the attempted regime change in Damascus. Nevertheless, the media presentation of the alleged atrocity very nearly led to direct U.S. involvement, and it's that fact which has troubled British journalist Robert Stewart, whose research exposed the many startling anomalies, inconsistencies, and outright falsehoods surrounding the BBC's Panorama documentary entitled Saving Syria's Children, since some of the program's source material was first aired as Parliament voted on August 29, 2013, on possible UK military intervention in Syria. We spoke with him via Skype from London Sunday.
This report by the BBC, the first footage was shown on the 29th of August 2013. This was exactly at the same time that Parliament was voting on whether to join a US-led military strike on Syria. So, you know, the timing was incredible. And the report itself was very harrowing. Scenes of school children or young men arriving at a hospital following an incendiary bomb attack, we're told, on a school playground about 12 or 14 kilometres away. Now, you watch it the first time, it is a very harrowing, very graphic report. But if you watch it again, it soon becomes, you know, absurd, frankly. You know, these people, these young men, you know, they're quite clearly engaging with the camera, that they're kind of stock still until they see the camera, at which point they start rolling and groaning and putting on this performance. So it's absolutely, you know, it quickly turns from into farce. And the shocking thing about this for me all the time, the reason I've spent 4 years pursuing it, is that this isn't some some activist footage, some third party footage that the BBC have been tricked into broadcasting. They produced this. This is their own product. It has the BBC logo on it. It was filmed by a BBC team. So this is why I'm focused on this to the exclusion pretty much of anything else, because I think it's absolutely key and an absolutely historic piece of propaganda. You know, whatever accusations are leveled against foreign media, so-called enemy state media, Russia, North Korea, Iran, this has never happened in those nations, and it's never happened in any other this hasn't been perpetrated by any other broadcaster in history, as far as I'm aware, to completely stage an atrocity using, well, they're not really actors because the acting is so dreadful, but presumably volunteers.
Right. And, you know, this, yeah, just for context, this is exactly the vote that ended up being the reason the U.S. didn't get involved in directly involved in Syria. The United States Congress was contemplating, doing a Libya-style intervention, and because the British Parliament voted it down, Obama wasn't able to get that from the Congress.
That's right. Our Prime Minister at the time, David Cameron, lost the vote. Now, this was, hugely unexpected. And yes, it had that knock-on effect that you describe. And I'm sure the people who put this report together, the timing of it was such that it was too late to influence Parliament, people who are actually making that decision. But it seemed quite clearly intended to shore up public opinion, because, how many wars have there been, and how tired are the British public?
Right.
The global public of them. So, this was put out at a key moment, to reinforce the public's support for what was planned to be another military intervention.
Like a level of development of this kind of fakery, basically. We had the Kuwait incubator babies story with a couple of photographs, and we found out later that this actually came from the Kuwait royal family in the 1991 Iraq war. And then we had various fake media reports, and we're still finding out that some of the documentation that the U.S. used for the second Iraq war was fake. And then we saw some video of a staged rally that RT shot in the Benghazi for Libya at the beginning of that. But this is an actual, it's almost like a home movie, or not even, like a Hollywood production that they do here. And I'm guessing as people get more and more skeptical that they felt the need to just keep upping the game.
Well, I mean, this is indeed why I'm so focused on it. As I say, it's astonishing to me that the BBC would produce this themselves. Well, when I say the BBC, I mean, who knows what other agencies were involved, but certainly BBC personnel. But it's interesting you mention Nurse Naira, because there's a very clear parallel with one of the doctors who appear in this report. So there are two British doctors. One of them is a British Syrian doctor. Her name's Dr. Rola Hallam, and what the BBC don't tell us about this doctor who's fronting this report is that she is the daughter of a very prominent person in the Syrian opposition, a doctor called Dr. Musa al-Kurdi. Now this guy has appeared on Al Jazeera. He appeared on Al Jazeera to talk about his attendance at the Friends of Syria summit in 2012, where he was personally lobbying foreign ministers of the USA, Canada, Turkey to arm the Syrian opposition. Now, this is a very high level player in the Syrian National Council, or connected to the Syrian National Council. This is her daughter who's fronting this, his daughter rather, who's fronting this you know, sort of landmark piece of propaganda for the BBC. And this is not mentioned at all by the BBC. And also on the sophistication of the report, I mean, the other doctor who appears in this report is a doctor called Salia Hassan. Now, she's a British Muslim doctor. She's also a former army captain. She served in Bosnia, in the British Army, for the British Army. And about a year after saving Syria's children, because I should say this BBC 10 o'clock news, this sort of 4 or 5 minute excerpt was kind of the prelude to a full BBC Panorama program a month later, called Saving Syria's Children, which contained a lot more footage of this incident, and you know, it's all of it looks iffy. But the other doctor who appears, Dr. Salia Hassan, she then appeared on the BBC a year later, explaining, fronting a report about something called Hospex, which is hospital exercises, which the British military run, and it's for training British Army medical services for deployment. And they use actors in the training, but they use highly sophisticated injury simulation techniques, highly sophisticated makeup effects. And, you know, the parallels with the kind of injuries that we can see in the BBC's reports in Saving Syria's Children are just incredible. I mean, some of them are almost like shot for shot the same. Mm. But this is admitted, you know, this was kind of like a piece for a British news program, just, you know, kind of a PR for the British military medical services. But it kind of showed you how this kind of work is done. And when you go to the website of the company who were involved in these fake injuries in the Hospex report, that their website very clearly says that they are expert in simulating chemical, radiological, biological, and nuclear injuries, that they work with various military forces internationally. They can easily travel internationally as they're a mobile team. They can work in any location. So, I mean, that was very interesting to me, because the BBC, because I had a long complaints correspondence with the BBC about Saving Syria's Children. You know, in one of their final letters, they said, the BBC said, well, it's impossible for such a report to be staged because on the front line of an ongoing conflict. Well, here's a company whose work has also been showcased separately in another BBC report, saying on their website they can travel international, they can go to any location, and they work with the British military and other military forces internationally. So, you know, that's a clear indication of how such an event could be staged. Yeah. I mean, independently of that, I've accumulated quite a lot of evidence which clearly suggests that the event was staged. I mean, I've been in touch with people inside Syria who've conducted interviews with residents of the town where this incendiary attack is supposed to have happened. People there haven't heard of it. The people I know in Syria also spoke to somebody in the Free Syrian Army, a commander of the Free Syrian Army. Now, I don't know if this guy is alive or dead now, but this was in 2014. He testified that he was in that area in northwest Aleppo, and you know, there was no attack with napalm. You know, this didn't happen. He was very adamant about that, and he even invited the BBC to come over, and he would escort them safely to the town, Umm El Kubra it's called, and you know, allow them to interview witnesses and to do some, you know, further research. But of course, I included this offer in my complaints correspondence, which went on for about a year, and the BBC just ignored it, you know, and just dismissed it. So, and of course, you know, if you look at the footage frame by frame, you can catch glimpses of people smirking and grinning. Yeah. If you go to, there's a lot of associated YouTube footage. I mean, the BBC, you know, were relatively careful. I mean, it still looks quite shoddy, but they were relatively careful in the shots they chose. But when you go to YouTube and see footage which other people filmed on their phones, I guess, and put onto YouTube, you know, it's kind of farcical. You know, it's when you get these videos translated from the Arabic, that the stories people are giving contradict what the BBC tell us. I mean, a lot of these people can barely keep a straight face. There's a medic who was in attendance who we see in the BBC report. He's interviewed the next day. He can't keep a straight face. So there's all this kind of supporting evidence. But and another big thing is that nobody can agree when this bomb happened. You know, it's there's a kind of 6-hour range. Human Rights Watch say it was midday. Other groups say it was 2 p.m. And people are directly quoted saying, "I heard about it at 3 p.m. Whereas the reporter in the BBC complaints correspondence said very clearly in response to me, it happened at 5:30 p.m. It goes all the way up to 6 p.m. I questioned the cameraman at an event in London where he was giving an interview. And this is quite interesting, actually. This was at, a journalist club called the Frontline Club in London. And the cameraman, Darren Conway, was doing a kind of retrospective of his career. And I asked him about this point about when this attack is supposed to have happened. And he gave a very stumbling answer. He said, "Oh, I don't know, somewhere between 3 and 5. He got quite angry. and it wasn't clear. You know, he was unclear. He said somewhere between 3 and 5, whereas his colleague in panel had very clearly said 5:30. And there were these other accounts ranging from midday up until 6 p.m. Anyway, the interesting thing was that this interview from the Frontline Club, who put all their videos online, has never appeared online. And wow. This was back in 2014. So that interview was is being withheld. And,
right.
Yeah.
Squashed.
Yeah. So, you know, you can dig around this and, you know, the inconsistencies and the contradictions. I mean, the two doctors who are involved, they contradict each other. One of them just contradicts herself. Every time she opens her mouth about it, she gives a different number of victims, different, you know, accounts of pretty much everything. You know, she can't get her story straight at all.
So, and then we also have, I mean, the reporter, Ian Pinnell, and Conway, the cameraman, were embedded with Ahar Al-Sham.
This is something I hadn't spotted, but somebody pointed this out to me earlier in the year, that in one part where they're traveling to a frontline clinic, they say that it's too dangerous for them to travel in Syria alone, so they have their own security, and you can see from inside one of the cars that the logo of this group, Ahrar al-Sham, on the front of the car. Now this group, Ahrar al-Sham, was co-founded by a guy who's been described as Osama bin Laden's most trusted courier.
Right.
I called Mohammed Bahaya, I think is his real name.
Right. Yeah.
And he was also Ayman al-Zawahiri, the al-Qaeda leader's main representative in Syria at that time when he founded this group. So this is a group with direct links to al-Qaeda. And I think on the 4th of August, this group was working, took part in an atrocity in Latakia alongside ISIS, al-Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda, and a few other groups. Ahrar al-Sham, ISIS, and al-Nusra Front, and two other groups, were the main organizers and executives of these attacks. Over 200 civilians were killed, around the same number kidnapped, mostly women and children. And it's you know, less than 3 weeks later, or something, 3 weeks later, that the BBC's Ian Paddle and Darren Conway are riding around in a car being chauffeured around Syria by this group which was working in partnership with ISIS. I think the partnership with ISIS ended sometime in 2014, but at that point they were a partner group of ISIS, and they were, you know, they had foundational links to al-Qaeda.
To al-Nusra too.
It's quite shocking. So I mean, I did write to my member of parliament, the shadow foreign secretary, Emily Thornberry, about this, and initially she was quite exercised by it. She said, "Yes, it's, you know, we can't have BBC license fee payer money used to pay for going towards being used to fund a jihadi group, which is Ahrar al-Sham are." But then, of course, she corresponded with the BBC, and the BBC just said, "Look, this guy's been, we've been dealing with this guy for years. We've refuted all his claims about this program. And, you know, and they barely even mentioned the new point. And at that point, she backed off and said, you know, this, I think the BBC have dealt with you, you know, fully and fairly, and I'm not having anything more to do with this. So she backed out, which was very disappointing, but predictable.
Yeah, I mean, that happens with so many of them. Then there's these photographs that with the dates that keep changing that are supposedly documenting this supposed event. And first they're August 25th. Go ahead.
Actually, you know what? I mean, along the way, quite a few of these things I've kind of dismissed. I've got, although I was quite caught up with them at the time. So, I mean, another one was the fact that Dr. Halam, on the 29th of August, I think the BBC edited her words to say she thought it was a napalm. And then when they showed this panorama program a month later, she was saying chemical weapon. But the fact, you know, and this was quite curious. I wanted to get to the bottom of it. The fact is, you know, it was all part of the same sentence. They just edited it slightly. And the explanation the BBC gave was that, you know, when they first broadcast this report on the 29th, they wanted to make it clear straight away that they believed it was an incendiary substance like napalm, because this was recently after Ghouta. So they didn't want to confuse the audience. And then when the full panorama program was broadcast a month later, they had time to give the doctor's full words, which included, you know, speculation as to whether it was a chemical weapon or napalm. Now, a lot of people got very exercised about this. They thought that, you know, that the words were being manipulated for sinister purpose. I don't actually think that was right. I kind of accept the BBC's explanation on that one point. It's kind of bizarre that, it's very telling that we're supposed to believe this doctor couldn't tell the difference between, you know, a chemical gas like sarin or napalm, you know, which there's kind of an absurdity at the center of it anyway.
Right.
But another kind of red herring, I think, was the thing about the dates of these photographs, because I think it's pretty clear that whatever happened or whatever was staged, it did happen or was staged on the 26th of August. So the fact that these photographs by this journalist, which he uploaded to a citizen journalist website, he dated them the 25th of August initially. I think he just put the date in incorrectly and it was later changed to the 26th. But what turned out to be interesting about that is that I put this when I was still uncertain about it. I mentioned it in my complaint to the BBC. And Ian Pannell responded, because he was the author of the first few responses to my replies. He responded to say, well, you know, yeah, it just goes to show that there's a lot of these kind of attacks happening. I don't recognize any of the people in these photographs. Well, but when you look at the sort of pattern of these injuries or alleged injuries or, you know, made up injuries, whatever they are, it's very clear that the guys, you know, that they were the same people that were in his report. So he was claiming not to recognize these people. And one of them in particular is a very distinct sort of pattern of injuries. It looks very severe. So, you know, at the point where it seemed that the date contradicted the BBC narrative, Ian Pannell was claiming not to recognize these victims. And yet later on, you know, when the website in question had changed the date, you know, the BBC had to admit that, yes, they are the same people, you know, when I pointed out to them clearly. So although there have been a few sort of red herrings along the way, but it's been interesting sort of what they've brought to light just by sort of pursuing them. I mean, the thing about the napalm chemical weapon edit, you know, it turns out, in my view, not to be very significant, but that is the thing that got this wider attention in the first place. So, you know, it's it was quite useful.
Mm. And then also there was reference of this matter to Ofcom, I guess, and yeah. RT also covered it.
RT covered it in 2014, and they did make a big deal of the chemical weapon napalm edit. They, I think the argument they tried to make was that the words were changed to chemical weapon at a time when, you know, in order to kind of influence at a time when Obama was talking about the red line. But I think actually that doesn't really stack up. I think if they were trying to claim chemical weapon, they would have done it straight away, you know. So anyway, there was this report on RT, which I contributed to, and they used material from my blog. It was a bit of a tabloidy program. It was a little bit incautious with some of the language, but the basic point that this thing was a fake. Yeah, that, you know, I completely endorse that. But the BBC weren't happy. The BBC, I believe, asked off, you know, reported this to Ofcom. I don't think anybody else did. I believe that came from the BBC itself. And, you know, Ofcom found against the RT report on sort of, you know, on points such as, you know, that they referred to my sort of blog and my letter writing as a massive public investigation or something, which is obviously a bit of an exaggeration. Yeah. And I think the Ofcom also found that they didn't give the BBC adequate right of response or something.
Yeah, these are things that in the US there's no, you know, they did away with the equal time rule back in the 80s here. It's open season now. The US media is like, you know, the Daily Mail or worse over there. I see two findings. One was Rule 7. Broadcaster is required to allow sufficient right of reply to anyone accused. And they said RT didn't give BBC a chance to reply sufficiently. The other being that they're not to present facts in a way likely to mislead the viewer. And so using superlatives, you know, might do that. Here in the United States, all of that is common. You know, that's the way they report, quote unquote. So.
Sure. But you know, what is very interesting is that Ofcom made it very clear that they hadn't investigated the BBC's reports, and there were no, you know, this wasn't part of their remit. They weren't investigating the substance of RT's claims, you know, which is, and when the BBC and when the UK media reported this finding, that was, you know, left out.
Yeah, it says Ofcom is not a fact-finding tribunal and is not able or empowered, therefore, to establish the truth, blah, blah, blah. This all happens in a much larger context, of course, because this isn't the only incident that's been, used or attempted to be used to catalyze public opinion to support yet another war. And it's, not the only time it's ever going to happen again. Just look around, you know, there are people that are looking to have a war with Russia. I assume that's going to require some kind of incident also when the time comes. And, you know, what lessons are we learning from this particular incident?
Well, as I say, I don't think this will so easily happen again. And I don't think it has happened before. This is why I'm kind of obsessed with it, is because I believe it is historically unique. You know, it's happened in drama, Wag the Dog, you know, completely broadcasting fiction as fact. But I don't, I think perhaps it won't be used again because it's kind of dangerous to them. I think the BBC have left themselves very vulnerable on this. So the lessons learned for the BBC is, don't employ Ian Paddle. I mean, he's left. He's now with ABC News. Although Darren Conway is still working with them, and the team, their researchers and translators, that team from Saving Serious Children is still working with the BBC. I am fixed on this case. It's a historic case. But the point I wanted to make is, they have made themselves vulnerable on this. In particular, you know, having used what I would call volunteers or, you know, very amateur actors, these people are out there and can be traced and interviewed, and I have found one of them. I found one of the people who, she doesn't appear in Saving Serious Children itself, but she appears in one of the YouTube films which was uploaded shortly afterwards. And you know, she's in this hospital with this white burn cream being applied to her face and surrounded by some of the people we do see in the BBC's report. So this is somebody who was there and just, you know, completely unexpectedly, just as a kind of byproduct of sort of all the activity and I've been doing around this, she got in touch on Facebook. She messaged me on Facebook and asked me to take down a photograph which she claimed she was in. Well, she wasn't in that particular photograph.
She was on the set.
She was on the set.
Yeah.
And I found images off her from a Facebook account. I didn't recognize her straight away, but then a few weeks later, I found this video where, and she's there. And I've spoken to, I know her name. I know roughly where she lives. She lives in Amsterdam. The people who took part in this, I think it's pretty clear they weren't incendiary bomb victims. They didn't die, as is claimed. You know, they're out there. You know, the net is closing on this because we can find these people.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.